2106, Oscar Salazar by the parents of Nick Frank Vanilla and Oscar Salazar, versus District of Columbia and Delaware County. Mr. Love, the appellant, the guilty, the absolute.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Richard Love for the District of Columbia defendants. Initially, I'd like to discuss four reasons why the text and the structure of the Medicaid statute precludes the conclusion that Congress unambiguously intended to confer individual rights to enforce these PSDT provisions. First, the Medicaid Act does...
Before you do that, could you address the question of whether we have jurisdiction to hear the case at all?
Yes, certainly, Your Honor. I think unquestionably this court does have jurisdiction. The reason is that the order in question is plainly an interlocutory order of the district court refusing to dissolve or modify an injunction. The consequence of the district court's order is to deny relief on the discrete legal issue. It's separated from the rest of the district's motion. And the consequence of that ruling in the, is to deny the district's request to dissolve its injunctions.
Has the court denied the your motion or just one of the grounds?
Right. There is a outstanding independent issue, which...
There's only one motion, right?
There was only one motion, and the court agreed to separate the issue of whether there was a private right of action from the second independent issue with which...
What if you had divided it into six independent issues and lost the first one? Could you have appealed then?
Well, I think it depends on the circumstances. I think here, yes, because I think we're not moving as a final judgment. We're moving under whether it is...
Well, if you had divided into 10, you would appeal each one. We would hear it. Maybe you'd lose. You go back. Judge would decide the next one. You'd appeal it. That's the way this would go.
Well, I think that the what the court has the distinction that the court made in the CIA case that the appellees referred to dealt with a motion for summary judgment, which had a variety of issues, mm-hmm. And the court held that if the issues weren't resolved on their merits. That it would run counter to the concern about having piecemeal appeals. But the court in a subsequent case, I think it's the AMA v. Eastern Airlines case, said, nonetheless, if the order is from a denial of a request for termination of injunctive orders, which this case is, it's not a motion for summary judgment.
That case was not... the one you're talking about, the IAM case, there was a single issue. There was only one issue, and that was resolved. It wasn't a situation where somebody tried to split, either, and nothing wrong with having the court decide one issue after another. But the Supreme Court's opinion relies very heavily on the point about piecemeal litigation, even in the injunction situation. And let me put it another way. Is there any other case where this court has ever ruled on one of two grounds for either granting or denying an injunction? This would apply both ways, right? Granting and denying an injunction, right?
Yeah. I think that even if the court proceeded under a Carson analysis, I think there is jurisdiction to consider this issue under a Carson analysis. I mean, there clearly is irreparable harm.
Where's the serious hardship?
Well, the district suffers every day under an injunction that removes its authority to manage a federally supported local program.
It's the same, right? You'll be under the same hardship before it now that you were before. Nothing's changed, right?
Well, nothing's changed except that we cannot get review of an essential predicate to that injunction, and that is whether or not it's sufficient to confer a private right of action on these plaintiffs merely because they're the intended beneficiary, when there is not an unambiguous intent in either the structure or the text of the act to confer a private right of action.
How compelling an argument is that to the district? You've waited an awfully long time to bring it.
Understand, Your Honor. I think that's true. Administrations change.
Wasn't it compelling before? I mean, there have been a lot of administrations in between. And if this was really an enormously irreparable injury, wouldn't somebody have noticed it before?
Well, perhaps, but I don't think that cuts against the right of the District of Columbia to raise that issue now.
Oh, no, that's a different question. Of course, I don't think you're going to get, at least you have no argument from me, that you have the right to raise the issue. The question is whether you have the right to raise the issue today, or whether you have to finish the motion that you brought below before you can bring it.
All right. Well, if I could address the second prong of Carson, and that is the need for an immediate review in this court. The court's order, first of all, did, and it was at the defendant's suggestion, split these two issues. And secondly, there has been no movement whatsoever on bringing the second issue that was raised in that motion forward.
And
there's
whose
been
fault
no opposition.
Have you moved for summary judgment on that?
Well, we filed the motion. No opposition has even been filed. And the court has taken no action to move
Do you need any discovery on it?
Well, the plaintiffs argued that they need sweeping discovery on it.
Did you need any discovery on it?
No.
Why didn't you file another motion with the district court to resolve that issue?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I know
well,
that
do
we
know
have
the,
not.
You're the District of Columbia. I mean,
I thought you told the district court or asked the district court to decide the legal question first, and then discovery would proceed. I mean, that's in the representation.
Right. I think that's correct. But discovery hasn't proceeded.
But I mean, you contemplated that there would be discovery. That's all.
Well, I think the scope of that discovery probably is in dispute. But yes, you know, some discovery was contemplated, but the issue's never been brought forward. And there's absolutely no resolution of that second issue in sight.
It's one thing as if you had tried to get it resolved and you had what you told that you didn't tell the district court that if the district court ruled against you, you were going to appeal. You told the district court that if the district court ruled against you, the rest of the case would proceed. And it wouldn't take long to resolve that question, so it wouldn't slow up the rest of the case. But this appeal does slow up the rest of the case. So,
well, it doesn't have to. There's no reason why the case couldn't have proceeded on the second issue. And it's since August 2010. Now it's over 14 months that there's been no movement forward. And I think.
And why didn't you just file for judgment? I mean, if nothing's happening and if they're not engaging in discovery and this is a terrible injury to the district, why not say something? I mean, you did take the opportunity to argue up here, to file an appeal here. It couldn't have cost much in terms of the counsel's office to file the same papers with the district court.
I can't argue against the court.
The problem for us the problem for us, obviously, and it's the problem that's discussed in Carson, even with respect to injunctions, is that this case could well go away on your second point below. And you're asking this court to permit the division of motions for relief in both directions, granting and denying, in a way that would transform the injunction practice. And when I say that I haven't seen a case in this circuit, I haven't seen a case in any circuit that's divided it this way. Have you?
We haven't cited to any outside of what is in our briefs. I don't have
If we were to do this, this would be an open invitation in every injunction case to have every time an issue is decided against a party to have an immediate run upstairs for or downstairs, depending
on
where.
Well, no, I respectfully disagree. I mean, the district could have brought these issues in separate motions.
Well, the district, that's what you say. But right. Again, no citation for the proposition that the district court wouldn't have been perfectly within its rights to then consolidate the two motions. I mean, if all you're going to, if you say you could get around it by filing two motions, the district court could easily regard those as the same motion in two parts.
Well, they are in two parts. Excuse me.
I mean, what we don't have here is any other court that's decided this, and we don't have a rule like 54B, where the district court, you could ask the district court to certify this threshold question of law, get a decision before both parties spend a lot of time, effort, money, et cetera, on discovery and a trial.
But I think you do have, Your Honors, a rule that permits an appeal of an injunction or the refusal to dissolve an injunction. And the whole basis, I mean, basically what I understand the plaintiffs to be arguing is that there's not a final decision, but 1292A1 is an exception to the rule on finality. And plaintiffs' argument
that... narrow.
Excuse me?
It's narrow. That's what we're focusing on.
Well, I understand it's narrow, but I think that the court, the district's motion squarely requested that the court terminate its injunctions. It wasn't a motion for summary judgment that had the practical effect of denying injunctive relief. It was a specific request tailored to terminate the district court's injunction.
Well, why does a motion in the Swiss cheese? I like to call it that case. Mm-hmm. Why did that? It didn't really terminate the decision. It just denied summary judgment. Could go on to trial. That's not the end of it. If you move for summary judgment and you lose, you go on to trial.
Well, it's like a preliminary injunction, however. I mean, a preliminary injunction is temporary. Ultimately, the court could decide not to issue a permanent injunction, and nonetheless, 1292A1 would allow for an appeal. So I think these are similar circumstances. The one other point on the Carson issue that I wanted to point out was in Carson, I believe, the court recognized that just the cost of litigation was an irreparable harm in and of itself. That was a case where they denied a request to accept the consent decree. I mean, certainly that the irreparable harm that the district advances here is far more significant than merely the cost of the litigation, although that's a component of this.
So you say you could have filed two motions. The other way to proceed, and tell me what's wrong with this, you could have filed the motion on the ground that there is no private right of action, period.
Yes.
Without prejudice to raising further arguments as to why the injunction should be dissolved.
Yes, we certainly could have, and that's why we submit that really elevates form over substance to preclude review of this essential issue.
I just want to be clear that the district wouldn't be in the position of somehow having waived an argument because it didn't present it in its initial motion for dissolution of the injunction. You know, in this particular case, for example, where the district withdrew its appeal or didn't, it caused the district procedural problems down the road, and I just wanted to be clear whether you thought there was any procedural or substantive problem down the road if you hadn't raised the second ground in your motion.
Your Honor, to be honest, I wasn't trial counsel and I wasn't privy to the strategy that was led to a decision to form the motion as it did. But I think that is a legitimate concern. We've had a history of procedural problems in this case, as the Court's well aware, and in other institutional reform cases. Mm-hmm. I'm in my rebuttable
time. Just follow up on Judge Rogers' question. I think to put the point on it, you could really risk a 60C problem here, right? Because you already have a problem with respect to timeliness, one which for myself, I think the government has the right to raise this issue, even if they thought of it too late, even if they thought of it late. But if you would try to get around the piecemeal litigation thing, and you would raise one motion and one issue, and not the obviously completely tied second issue. I mean, the way this is, the argument is that the plaintiffs have no private right of action. And even if they do, they've achieved compliance. Now, if you raise the first and not the second, I think you would you would certainly risk a C1 problem of not having raised it within a reasonable time, even if the court would have agreed to the first one as being okay. At that point, you had more than insufficient notice, and you had already raised the issue. It's a little hard to say. And by the way, when the court asks, why did you not raise the second one? And your answer is, as an officer of the court, because we wanted to make an appeal of the first one. We thought we wouldn't be able to do that if we joined the two together. I think you would have a serious problem. So it's not clear to me that there is a workaround here for you if you can't bring them when they're together, that you could bring them separately. Am I wrong about that? Wouldn't that be considerably risky?
I think that may, certainly have been the case. As I said, I wasn't privy to the discussion.
I'm not asking for your tactical right. judgment.
Right. No, I think in factually, that's correct. I see I'm running out of time, and I haven't reached the merits.
All right. Well, why don't we hear from counsel for appellees, and we'll give you a few minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, I am Kathleen Millian for the plaintiff class, Oscar Salazar. The District of Columbia's appeal of the August 2010 order of the District Court denying one part of its motion to terminate the settlement order is not proper because it is interlocutory and would result in piecemeal litigation.
Let me ask you, the district argues the plain text of the rule, all right? And then it says, as we've just been discussing with counsel, wouldn't you be objecting and saying the district had waived its second argument had it not presented it initially as part of its motion for dissolution?
Well, Your Honor, its second argument is a factually based argument where the defendants say, we are in compliance with the settlement order, and then they had a third aspect to it to say, even if we are not in compliance with the settlement order, we're in compliance with federal law. That's a factually based argument. So it depends on the timeliness of it, depends on when the conditions began to exist that defendants are relying on to say.
But that wasn't my question.
I'm sorry.
I'm trying to understand if there's any procedural obstacle that the district would have faced had it not raised this second argument.
The factual argument.
That's right. That they are in compliance. And as you point out, that's a factual question. And as I understand the record, you need discovery. And so presumably that's going to take some time, and any final judgment on the merits by the district court will take some time. And do you understand the rules simply to bar this type of appeal?
We understand the rule to bar splitting apart a motion and appealing one part of it when only one part of your motion has been decided.
Even in institutional litigation where necessarily, because of the nature of the litigation, it's going to take a lot of time by counsel as well as the court, the trial court. That there's no exception for institutional litigation is what I'm getting at.
Your Honor, we do not think there is any exception for institutional litigation under Rule 60 and how it applies. As Your Honor mentioned, defendants did have a procedural option. They could have asked the district court to certify the question. They did not choose that option.
Did the district court have any authority to do that? I didn't see that in the rules. I was referring to 54B, but, that's in connection with summary judgment. So you think the district court might have had authority?
It might have. I haven't examined that question. It might have had authority to certify the legal question, but defendants did not proceed that route.
So just hypothetically, the Supreme Court tomorrow issues a decision based on the very sections that you've cited in your complaint of the Medicaid statute, and says there is no private right of action here. Now, in that case, it seems to me the district could move for dismiss, and the district court would be bound by that. If the Supreme Court, however, didn't decide precisely on the sections you've cited, but on analogous provisions. As I understand it, the only thing the district can do is what it did here, and then we wait for a couple of years for the final judgment, even though, in my hypothetical, it would seem 99.9% clear that the Supreme Court has indicated there is no private right of action here. And that may be the law, but I just want to be clear if that's your position.
Well, Your Honor, if the Supreme Court ruled tomorrow that there is no private right of action under EPSDT, we would submit that that does not resolve this case or result in the termination of the EPSDT portions of the consent decree. And I just want to clarify, there are other parts of the settlement order in this case that remain pending.
Like
the recertification processing. There is a due process constitutional claim that plaintiffs have made and obtained relief for in the settlement order concerning the processing of Medicaid recertifications. People are dropped at recertification time every year or every 6 months. If you're on Medicaid, you have to recertify and show that you're continue to be eligible. People are dropped without proper advance written notice. There's a standard.
And all this can come up even without, just because it's a constitutional claim. That's your point.
That's right. There's no question about a private right of action there. But going back to the statutory private right of action question, we would maintain that on the facts of this case, the circumstances of this case, where there has been an adjudication in the district court that plaintiffs have a private right of action concerning EPSDT, that that question is not a subject matter jurisdiction question. It is a question that goes to the merits as to whether plaintiffs raised a claim on which relief can be granted. So even if the Supreme Court issued an adverse decision while this case isn't in front of this court, that would not necessarily resolve the matter, and we certainly would want to brief the question as to whether necessarily such a decision would dissolve the EPSDT part of the settlement order. And I wanted to also respond briefly to just the part of defendant's motion about EPSDT. As Your Honors have noted, defendants made their legal argument that there's been a significant change in law, and it also made a factual argument that they were in compliance. So they raised point A and point B as to why the district court should dissolve the EPSDT portions of the settlement order. And while the district court did not agree with defendants' reading of the law as to part A, it has not yet addressed part B, the factual allegations defendants make to assert that they are in compliance with EPSDT, the EPSDT portion of the settlement order.
Why haven't you gone forward with the discovery in the case?
Your Honor, the status of the motion is that promptly after it was filed in 2009, plaintiffs filed for a motion for extension of time on the briefing in order to conduct discovery and for leave to conduct discovery, which we have to ask for leave since we're in the post-judgment phase. The district court initially granted that, but then on defendant's motion for reconsideration, the court reconsidered and accepted defendant's procedure of deciding first the legal question, not allowing any discovery.
I understand that, but then it decided that one,
and correct.
Its denial of your request for discovery was without prejudice. So why didn't you move after you won the first point to go forward with discovery?
Because this is defendant's motion for relief. Defendants promptly, immediately filed an appeal with this court on the legal question and moved that that appeal be expedited.
Did that deprive us, deprive the district court of jurisdiction?
I'm not sure about whether it did or not. It may have, but the district court, the plaintiffs then promptly moved to dismiss this appeal on the very grounds we're discussing right now, that it was an improper interlocutory appeal.
I'm still not sure why. I mean, you think you're going to win on appeal, so therefore you could have gone forward. It was your motion for discovery, as opposing counsel points out, not their motion for discovery. It was their motion, but your motion for discovery, which you needed in order to defend. So why not continue the litigation in the district court? What's the reason for the delay?
Your Honor, it was our motion for discovery, but only in response to their motion. And since the this is a common practice in the district court. When some of the motions that are brought to enforce or to vacate involve discovery, where plaintiffs request discovery. The common practice is that we stay the briefing, we move for discovery, we have disputes about discovery, the discovery is produced, and then the parties propose a briefing schedule to the court to continue. Plaintiffs are ordinarily the moving party there, and we take the lead on ensuring that the motion gets back on a briefing schedule. Similarly here with defendants, they have taken no action to ask the district court to set a briefing schedule to complete the second part of its motion going to this EPSTT question that they've raised before this court.
So it's a procedural argument, Alphonse and Gaston here. You're saying that standard practice is the district's holding this case up from proceeding in discovery that you say you need, just so I'm clear.
Well, Your Honor, it's their motion, so the moving party ordinarily takes a step.
The case is still in the district court. That's your position.
As to the factual aspect of their motion
to
dismiss, yes.
Have we lacked jurisdiction?
Yes.
So you're not going to do anything until we rule, is that? We're just trying to understand why this thing isn't moving.
That's right, Your Honor. As to this point, since it is defendant's motion, we are not taking any steps to move their motion forward towards decision in the district court.
Even though you're claiming it's pending in the district court still?
Correct. It is still pending in the district court, not fully briefed, not ready for decision by the district court. Ordinarily here, the defendant would have moved the district court to set a briefing schedule to complete the resolution of its motion. I'm not sure what reasons it has not done that.
So if the district did that, you would certainly bring that to our attention as further grounds for arguing that we lack jurisdiction.
Perhaps we would, Your Honor.
What's the support for the district court's determination that bringing this issue is untimely?
What's the support?
Yeah.
The district court's careful analysis of that question about timeliness. It looked at the 7-year delay and the reason given for the delay, which was that the priorities of the elected officials in the District of Columbia had changed between the time Gonzaga was issued and 7 years later when defendants made its motion.
But we decided in Salazar that in this exact kind of litigation, it would be an abuse of discretion to rule against the government that the 60B6 motion is not filed within a reasonable time without finding that the movement's delay has prejudiced the non-moving party. And the prejudice can't simply be finality, because if that were all there was to it, there wouldn't be any reason for us to have written those words.
Right, Your Honor.
What's the particular kind of prejudice, other than the, you know, the prejudice of repose, of, you know, undoing the repose here? What's the particular kind of prejudice that justifies a conclusion that it's too late to raise this issue?
The prejudice that the district court found after applying the standards in RUFO and Horn versus Flores, of course, this court's decision of February 2011 had not yet been issued.
Right.
Looking at the facts of this case, the record showed that the district made an appeal in 1998 on the exact grounds that they sought to raise again, which is whether plaintiffs had a private right of action about EPSTT. The record showed that plaintiffs at that time had a cross appeal raising other issues, which they hoped to obtain additional relief from what the district court had ordered. Both parties compromised and abandoned those appeals and asked the district court to enter the settlement order. So in the words of the district court, as part of its analysis, granting defendants the right to raise this issue now would deny plaintiffs their bargained for interest in finality.
Right, but that's where I started, which is, after Salazar, it doesn't seem that bargain for interest in finality is sufficient. That somehow your ability to make the argument now that you didn't make then, or to pursue the argument, which you would now be doing, would be prejudiced in some way. You're not in any worse of a position of arguing about whether there's a cause of action here now than you would have been before.
Well, Your Honor, the situation facing this court in the February 2011 Salazar decision was that there had been no, the district court did not address this question of prejudice to the plaintiffs. In our situation in the August 2010 decision, the court did address prejudice and focused on this issue about parties who make bargains in reaching settlements and looked at the record and focused on that. She said that the district court said that if this kind of late motion 7 years after a Supreme Court decision was proper, then it would undermine the confidence of the community in the district's willingness to stand by
in the other Salazar case, which appropriately has exactly the same name, which was also a settlement, obviously. There would have been no reason to say that, because basically what you're saying is that any settlement, I mean, there's an argument for that, but it's an argument that the court rejected, that in any settlement there is this interest in repose of the community being able to rely on the results of each party having given up its rights to appeal at that moment.
Your Honor,
what makes this different than that?
There is one distinction. The order at issue in the February 2011 decision of this court was not the settlement order. It was an ancillary order issued by the district court, not agreed to by the defendants, to enforce the settlement order for dental services for children. So it wasn't the exact same question.
Right.
It was not
an
agreed to order.
So it wasn't bargained. I thought your
argument wasn't bargained for in the Salazar February 2011 decision.
That wasn't a bargained for order.
No. Your Honor, if there are no further questions, plaintiffs submit that this appeal should be dismissed. In the alternative, the order of the district court should be affirmed.
Thank you. Counsel for the district.
You know, just briefly, I think we've discussed the sort of procedural quandary, which we believe would put the district in a position where it was unable to raise a fundamental issue.
Can I just ask you that? I'm sorry to interrupt. I don't see why 54B doesn't apply here. Why? Maybe the district court wouldn't have granted it, but if, in light of your ability to persuade the district court that it made sense to decide that first, why wouldn't 54B apply?
Well, I'm not certain. I think if I could answer the court's question by suggesting that Carson, I think, serves a 54B-like function, and here we have put,
you know what I'm going to say to that, which is not the answer to my question. I mean, right? I mean, 54B means you get the district court to agree to certify it, this legal question. It seems to me, on the words of the rule, that this would have been possible. You didn't try it.
We didn't try, Your Honor, and I don't know, again, I wasn't privy to the discussion.
That would be a way around this problem of a situation where there's a legal question. For example, in the question that Judge Rogers raised, what if there had been a direct decision of the Supreme Court on exactly the legal issue here, and nonetheless the district court wanted to continue on the facts, the opposing party wanted to continue, you could certainly certify that question.
Perhaps, Your Honor, but I do suggest that Carson does serve a 54B-like function, and we have satisfied the requirements of Carson, or at least we've submitted that we have, and I think explained that appropriately in our brief. Let me just quickly, in terms of the interest in finality, which this court has already said is diminished in the context of this case. And one of the reasons I think it is clear that a consent decree here is designed to remedy violations of federal law. It's not a private contract which is insulated from review when there are significant changes in fact or law. And that's what has occurred here. At the risk of taking too much time, if I could briefly just quickly try and address one critical issue on the merits, and that is the way I think an important distinction with the Wilder case. And because that's the one case that dealt with a Medicaid provision, we've explained, I think, clearly why we believe the scope of the of Wilder was narrowed by Gonzaga. But the very important distinction also is the way that courts have treated the enforcement mechanisms that are built into the Medicaid statute. I'm talking about a right that was required by the statute to fair hearings when medical care is delayed or denied, and the authority of the secretary to withhold funds. Most courts have discounted those remedies because they review them not with regard to the primary analysis to determine whether or not Congress unambiguously intended to confer private rights of actions. But to review, once having concluded that these mechanisms weren't sufficiently comprehensive to reverse the presumption that arises from the first sort of three-pronged analysis. I would submit, first of all, that's wrong, and we're asking the court to review that in the first instance as a indicia of Congress's lack of intent, certainly unambiguously, to confer private rights of action. The second thing is that the remedy in the Boren Amendment, which was at issue in Wilder, was unique because there was clear congressional language and history which indicated that they didn't intend to foreclose a private right of action, which had been commonplace prior to the passage of the Boren Amendment.
I think we have your argument.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll take the case under advisement.